Boston Club. He died in 2011, at the age of 96. On a more contemporary morning at Aquatic Park, the cold water sloshing around our shoulders, I ask Kim if she thinks certain bodies tend to do better in the bay. New research into human physical performance shows that elite swimmers, unlike elite runners, can excel with different body types across all distances. An analysis of runners in the 2012 London Olympics revealed that 200-meter sprinters were significantly larger than marathoners. But the corresponding 50-meter freestyle pool sprinters, for example, shared a similar body mass with the 10,000-meter open water marathoners, regardless of height or sex. All bodies can do well in water, it seems. But what about when the water is cold? Well, the theory is that you get more brown fat from being in cold water, Kim explains as we pause to tread water and chat. Brown fat burns energy and generates heat, and white fat doesn't. She laughs and shrugs. Or so I'm told. Not long after that swim, I drive 5 miles to the south, cross a bridgeway to a soaring, futuristic building with rooftop gardens overlooking Golden Gate Park, and duck into the office of Dr. Shingo Kajimura to talk to him about what fat, cold water, and health could possibly have to do with each other. He's a prize-winning biochemist at the University of California, San Francisco, who runs a lab that is trying to engineer the way fat cells fight obesity and metabolic disease. A boyish man, with a relaxed manner and ready smile, Kajimura is fascinated by how animals adapt to their environment. As a kid growing up in the Tokyo suburbs, his job was to catch fish for dinner. Sardines, say, or flounder. If he wasn't a scientist, he says, he'd be a fisherman and a sushi chef in San Francisco. His early curiosity about fish adaptations, how salmon can swim from freshwater to saltwater, for example, or how catfish can thrive in dirty water, led to an interest in how mammals could adapt to cold conditions. I was living in Michigan back then. I thought about cold all the time, he admits. But it was serendipitous because it got him interested in the cutting-edge science of fat. Kajimura tells me a tale of two fats. Humans, like other mammals, are born with two kinds of fat. White fat stores energy. Brown fat burns it, creating heat energy. Cold water swimming is a combination of chronic cold exposure and exercise, both of which are known to have a browning effect on white fat, turning it into what's called beige fat, and revving up your metabolism. Metabolism, of course, is a hot topic. Kajimura gets calls all the time from gyms in LA and New York. They say, "We'd like to start yoga in the cold. Is that good for you?" He says, laughing. I say, "It depends. Exercising in the cold is good for some people, but not others." He knows that it's not a neat or satisfying answer, but, well, that's science. White fat cells are almost 90% lipid. It's where our stores of energy live, says Kajimura. Brown fat cells, by contrast, are among the most mitochondria-rich cells in the human body. They are our fuel-burning engines. In the lab studies with mice, exercise induced the browning of white fat, which was increased further by cool temperatures. This beige fat protected the mice from obesity and diabetes, and they were able to stay lean and healthy even when fed a high-fat diet. But because the science is so new, brown fat was only proven to exist in human adults in 2009. The molecular level of these processes is not yet clear. Babies are born with lots of brown fat. Since babies don't have enough muscle to shiver when they're cold to generate heat, brown fat is very important to regulate body temperature, Kajimura explains. He shows me a scientific illustration. A human infant, shaded with brown areas on the back and neck, where brown fat deposits are rich. The major coverage area resembles nothing so much as a winter scarf draped around the neck. But there's a dramatic decline in brown fat when we reach our 50s and 60s, and it correlates neatly with age-related obesity. Most people gain weight at this time, and it's not because they're eating more, Kajimura says. It's very fascinating to us. You gain weight because your energy expenditure goes down. We don't fully understand why, but we speculate that the loss of brown fat contributes to it. What are the factors? Can we reverse the gain by creating new types of energy-burning brown fat even after you lose it? Cold exposure results in a stress response in our bodies. When you feel cold, your body compensates with blood flow and blood vessel formation and circulation. But while the cold is one of the most efficient ways to burn energy, even more than exercise is, it's lousy for your heart because cold stimulates vasoconstriction and your blood pressure goes up. Old people get strokes early in the morning in the wintertime, Kajimira tells me. Cold exposure is beneficial to healthy people, but not for people with heart trouble. It's the same for exercise. Weightlifting or intense exercise is not good for you if you have cardiovascular risk. We can't apply or generalize this as a therapy for everyone. It depends on your age, how healthy you are, your family history. But Kajimira finds the synergistic health pairing of swimming and cold water a tantalizing idea. When I was a kid in Japan, my grandmother would send me outside to play in the wintertime, he recalls. Her command, kids had to play outside in the cold. Take off a shirt, she said, and that would keep the doctor away. I've talked to people in Siberia, Russia. They jump into cold water all the time, Kajimira says, a bit wonderingly. It's terrible from a cardiovascular standpoint, but people realize that there is something good about this. Immunity, viral resistance. But we're not sure why that is. The specific mechanisms are still not completely understood, but evidence is accumulating. In 2012, Russia held its first winter ice swimming competition in the middle of a frozen lake in Tyumen, a town in the vast region of Siberia. Organizers cut 4 25-meter lap lanes into the ice. Swimmers flew in from all over the world to compete. The Israeli ice swimmer, Ram Barkai, who lives in South Africa and founded the International Ice Swimming Association in 2009 to standardize cold open water swimming, was one of them. Faced with the astounding cold on the first day of competition, Barkai and his fellow swimmers suppressed an extremely strong urge to drink ourselves silly, he writes in an account of that day. On the second day, the air was minus 22 degrees Fahrenheit. Wet towels left out after the previous day's races froze and stood straight at attention. The water temperature held at the freezing point, 32 degrees. Just before Barkai was called back for his 1 kilometer heat, he watched a Russian woman finish her endurance swim, swimming breaststroke with her head up, without goggles. Her eyelashes froze solid and she couldn't open them, writes Barkai. They basically dragged her to the sauna to slowly defrost her eyes. Moisture in the nose froze solid. Breathing was like inhaling wasabi in slow, shallow intakes. Any facial hair or long hair exposed to the icy air just froze immediately. Yet he notes that the water looked surprisingly inviting. Barkai describes the post-race prize, skin lobster red, body uncontrollably shivering, as the feeling of being intensely, vigorously alive. The cold and the swim gives one such a rush and sense of health and vigor, which is hard to explain unless you have done it. When I get him on the phone from his home in South Africa to ask him about ice swimming for wellness, Barkai laughs. Some people would argue that this is extreme unwellness, he says. I've been told by so many doctors I should have been dead long ago. But he continues to chase ice around the world in pursuit of his mad sport for the heightening experience that he describes in his account of that day in Siberia. He recently returned from another swim in the same place and wants me to know that a decade of ice swimming has only made him feel more robust. By the beginning of 2018, more than 250 people had swum a certified ice mile, a mile or more in 41-degree water or colder. Back in Kajimira's office, we marvel at the idea of swimming in a pool cut into the Siberian ice. I guess whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger, Kajimira says thoughtfully. I used to think it was all philosophical, but it might be true from a clinical standpoint. A glossary of common and not-so-common health ailments associated with swimming. Swimmer's ear. A bacterial or fungal infection of the outer ear canal brought on by water that stays in the ear after swimming, treated with eardrops to reduce inflammation and fight infection. Exostosis. An abnormal growth of bone within the ear canal that is caused by frequent exposure to cold water and windy conditions. often affecting surfers and divers. Once the growth blocks the ear canal, the condition requires surgery. Cryptosporidiosis, a gastrointestinal and respiratory illness caused by a hardy, chlorine-resistant parasite, and the most common infection at pools and water parks. Most people with healthy immune systems recover without treatment. Sea lice, stinging microscopic jellyfish larvae that often get trapped in the space between skin and swimsuit, causing itchy rashes and blisters. Corticosteroids or antihistamines can help alleviate the severity of the symptoms. Tinea pedis, or athlete's foot, common in damp locker rooms and swimming pools the world over, caused by a fungus that results in a scaly red rash, treated with antifungal medication. Legionnaire's disease, a severe form of pneumonia caused by the Legionella bacterium when it contaminates swimming pools, hot tubs, whirlpools, and other water systems. Prompt treatment with antibiotics is critical. Tendinitis, or swimmer's shoulder, a common inflammation of the fibrous cords connecting muscle to bone around the shoulder joint due to repetitive motions. Cross-training, stretching, strength training, and rest are recommended. Swimming-induced pulmonary edema, a sudden onset of excess fluid in the lungs that results in difficulty breathing and may be related to strenuous swimming and cold water immersion. Treatment includes oxygen therapy and monitoring. Green hair, it's a thing, results from the reaction of chlorine with copper and other hard metals found in pool water. Green-tinged oxidized metals are absorbed by the hair. Baking soda can help. Cercarial dermatitis, or swimmer's itch, a rash caused by an allergic reaction to burrowing parasites common in ducks and other birds that dwell in freshwater lakes and ponds. Calamine and antihistamines can reduce itching, but believe you me, they don't do much. You can call me the bumpy bride. My husband does. You can't see it in the pictures, but a decade ago, at the very moment of our heartfelt declarations before 100 of our closest friends and family, my skin was completely covered in a fine, full-body rash, head to miserably itching toe. On that bright summer afternoon, we were married on a spit of land overlooking Lake George and the Adirondack Mountains near the New York-Vermont border. It's a lake known for its pristine water, so clean that New York State classifies it as drinking water. The bumps were an allergic reaction to the microscopic parasites that normally live in the waterfowl that frequent that lake, the rashy horror that is swimmer's itch. I've endured all manner of welts to do what I love, swimming in Australia, surfing in Mexico, scuba diving in Panama. I've visited mosquito-filled Arctic summer beaches and sandfly-infested Hawaiian beaches. Always I return bearing itchy red badges of courage. Swimmer's itch. I try to own it. The swimming comes first, the suffering second. Still, these bugs define me somehow. In his wedding vows, my husband declared before witnesses that he could not promise to protect me from the biting, stinging creatures of land and sea. But he promised to try. Diana Nyad swam from Cuba to Florida and emerged unrecognizable because of jellyfish stings to her face. Lynn Cox was the first to swim in so many places, among them the Cape of Good Hope, patrolled by sharks and sea snakes. Martin Strel, the Slovenian hero in a Speedo, swam the piranha-infested Amazon, all 3,300 miles of it, risking the most agonizing of deaths by parasites, stingrays, and bull sharks. Most of the aforementioned are warm water afflictions, but I guess it's a kind of luck. Because at the very least, I can retreat to other colder waters, like those of San Francisco, which might just be specifically salutary to a swimmer like me. With all this talk of how cold water swimming can be good for you, I decide that I've got to lose the wetsuit. If 80-year-old Mimi can do it with such aplomb, I should at least try, right? Another early morning at the Dolphin Club, this time in mid-March, in the midst of a colossal downpour, the water temperature in the bay has ticked up to an almost balmy 56 degrees. Somehow it seems to always be raining when I go open water swimming, which makes for the unfortunate circumstance of clammy arrivals and departures. There isn't a soul in the water when I get to Aquatic Park to assess the conditions. I wonder if the reports of thunder and lightning are keeping swimmers away. But then Kim drives up and hops excitedly out of her car, a black Land Rover. "Woo!" she crows. On her advice, I go to stash a thermos of hot ginger tea in my locker for drinking in the sauna post-swim. "It'll help warm you up afterward," she says. "But don't worry, you'll do great." A steady stream of swimsuit-clad bodies rolls with us out of the locker rooms and onto the sand. South Enders mingle convivially with dolphin clubbers as everyone discusses the conditions while standing knee-deep in the lapping water. When I ask one swimmer, a middle-aged woman named Kate, how she'd characterize the two clubs, she confides that the dolphin club is like living with your parents, we're more conservative. The South End is like a frat house, they're more risky. Standing next to Kate is her friend, a South Ender, who laughs appreciatively at this. Kim proudly proclaims my maiden voyage to anyone within earshot. "This is Bonnie. She's swimming without a wetsuit today for the first time." I wave weakly. After a chorus of hellos, introductions, and a bit of trash talk, they all set off, one by one. Then it's my turn. I give the inside surface of my goggles one last swipe with my thumbs, steel my core muscles, and take the plunge. Immediately, as I stroke through the first 100 yards, the surface of my skin starts generating a peculiar prickly heat. It's a kind of ice fire, flaming its way all over my body. It lasts for about 60 seconds. And then, well, I feel fine. We swim around Hyde Park Pier and turn parallel to the shore, following a line of buoys west across the cove toward Aquatic Park Pier. Our swim is punctuated every now and again by Kim's signature whoops, every dozen breaths or so, to mark her enthusiasm for the whole venture. More than once, Kim has told me that there's a high to being in the rousingly crisp water, with just what we came into the world with and a bit of Lycra. And it's true. In my skin, I feel more than fine. I feel great, amazing, alive. The sky clears. We pause at the far side of the buoy, the one planted with a flag and a thermometer to check in with each other. Other swimmers join us at the flag as we tread water together. It's like a little tea party out there. By then, I don't feel the cold at all. "We'll take it easy since it's your first time," Kim cautions. "I know you can swim longer, but you'll get afterdrop. Your body temperature will keep dropping after you get out, and that's when you'll get really cold." Turns out when it comes to cold, the biggest threat isn't the swim itself, but the afterdrop that follows. On the buoy trail back to the club, I alternate between freestyle and breaststroke, enjoying the view of the sandy beach and its swimmers. Still, at the edge of my consciousness, there's a little lurking worry. I can't help but think about Guthlauger in the freezing North Atlantic, and of John Aldridge, the lobsterman from Long Island, my home island. In 2013, Aldridge fell overboard in the middle of the night off the coast of Montauk and survived the next 12 hours in 72-degree water by using his green rubber boots as flotation devices. What must it have been like to swim out there for so long in the cold? They were accidental swimmers in their cold water ordeals, and here we are doing it for fun. My 25-minute maiden journey is over like that, with a tidal adrenaline rush. But as we hit the beach, my left pinky finger starts to separate from the rest of my hand in a claw-like configuration, almost as a warning. In the shower, the afterdrop arrives. I furiously crank the faucet toward H, but I can't get warm or stop shivering no matter how far I turn the knob. My teeth chatter. As I rub my arms and legs, my jaw begins to clench. The Dolphin Club, as it happens, is where longtime member Thomas Nuckton, an intensive care specialist, made a sideline of studying hypothermia and afterdrop in his fellow swimmers. The current U.S. Coast Guard immersion survival tables and computer programs actually reference one of Nuckton's studies, which quantifies a shipwreck survivor's biophysical parameters with methods that were developed with Dolphin Club swimmers. His work over the past 2 decades illustrated the afterdrop phenomenon. Body temperatures continue to go down even after swimmers get out of the water, and mild hypothermia, a couple of degrees below normal, is fairly common. The takeaway? Open water swimmers, especially beginners, would be well advised to take it easy and carefully monitor their body's responses, especially after a swim is over. In a 2015 study of experienced ice mile swimmers, Swiss researchers who followed in Nuchten's footsteps found that hypothermia didn't actually set in until after the participants had finished their swims. Finally, after about 10 minutes in the sauna, nestled in the warm conversation and camaraderie that thrives there, I begin to regain control of my extremities. And as I go about the rest of my day, to a cafe for breakfast with Kim, and then off to meet a writing buddy, I feel a secret pride in my accomplishment. Later, I walk along the waterfront and observe the moody bay with its damp and flickering light. Today I swam out there with no wetsuit, I think. I smile to myself, newly attuned and alert to the pulse of the bay as an echo of my own. Why did I do it? I realize that it's because I want to knock on heaven's door and have a chat with the devil, too. I have been afraid of death since I was very small. I remember visiting my great-grandfather's grave in Brooklyn during the Spring Qingming Festival, when Taoists honor their dead with ancestral grave sweeping. We burned incense and joss paper ingots so my bak gong could have ghost money to spend in heaven. What defined those visits for me, though, was not the story of what we were doing and why we were doing it. It was fear. Fear of the dark, inexplicable unknown. Fear of not being. That deep anxiety over dying has stuck with me. Even though I am now grown, it is what jolts me awake in the night. Swimming in open water is one small way of confronting that, of getting closer to the fire of wanting to stay alive, of warding off death, without the terror of having to do it for real. Maybe it's a kind of dress rehearsal. The sea is a deep, alien place. There's an energy to it, an element of danger that requires a giving over of the self, that makes swimming in heavy water a kind of sacrament. It is a suitable environment to engage with the deep strangeness of the human mind and its fears. Our feet are taken out from underneath us. There are unknowable fathoms below. There are moments of terror. Safety is restored when we set foot on land again back in San Francisco. Though I shiver upon emerging, with the accomplishment comes a powerful sense of hale and hearty vigor, of physical fortitude, and gratitude, quite simply, that I get to feel this at all. Now every time I drive on the Bay Bridge, along the waterfront, or over the Golden Gate Bridge, I pause to reconsider the bay. For a few minutes each morning on the way to my office in San Francisco, I might lose myself in the landscape. Or I might see the evening water shelled with pink and wonder how it felt earlier that day. Was it charged with cold? Or had the sun warmed it enough to give one's entry something like a velvety comfort? 7. Open water, meet awe. We submerge ourselves in the natural world because the natural world has a way of eliciting awe. Every morning at 7 a.m. in Sydney, Australia, hundreds of swimmers gather at the city's famous Manly Beach for an open water swim. They swim about half a mile across a bay to Shelley Beach. Then they turn around and swim back. The locals describe it as their wake-up call. The swimmers wear bright pink swim caps. The squad was started by middle-aged women who wanted to gain courage from each other to swim that distance across the open water. In an essay about her daily outings with the group, the Australian writer and broadcaster Julia Baird observes the way they watch the scroll of scenery as they swim. Most days, at some spot along the mile-long route, heads will cluster, arms pointing down under the water at enormous blue groupers, white dolphins, color-changing cuttlefish, wobegongs, even tiny turtles and seahorses. Of the gangs of dusky whale sharks that swim beneath, Baird takes note. There's a reason a collective term for sharks is a shiver. Some days the swimmers are lashed by jellyfish and currents and powerful surf. When I was a college student studying abroad in Sydney, I swam frequently at Manly and can attest to the unpleasantness of the jellyfish. Some days the whales come. It's akin to a religious experience. As your arms circle, swing, and pull along the edge of a vast ocean, your mind wanders, Baird writes. With the drift into deeper waters comes freedom and the shift in perception that is awe. Awe, she continues, experienced when you witness something astonishing, unfathomable, or greater than yourself, ventilates and expands our concept of time. We feel light, suspended. Time slows down in the best way, and we feel that we have more of it. Psychologists at Stanford University and the University of Minnesota, led by researcher Melanie Rudd, have shown that after experiencing awe, we are more likely to help others and to be relaxed and satisfied with life. When I ask Rudd about her findings, she explains that the experience of awe heightens our focus on the present. It captivates people's attention and what is currently happening with them and around them, she says. And the effects of awe are striking even beyond the moment. It makes us feel more time-rich, less impatient, more generous. It helps us to be our better selves. And who doesn't want that? Back on the other side of the Pacific in San Francisco, Kim and I are swimming one morning when a seagull pegs me on the shoulder, mid-freestyle stroke. I nearly jump out of my swimsuit in surprise, and then I call out to Kim, "I think a bird just hit me," I exclaim, incredulous. "It's their swimming pool," Kim answers, laughing. "We're just the fools who think we can swim in it." Swimming is, by our human definition, a constant state of not drowning. The Oxford English Dictionary emphasizes the propulsion of the body through water with one's limbs and a position afloat on the water's surface. To drown is to die through immersion or submersion, the body under the surface, in water, and inhalation of that water. We know from the most ancient of times that the boundary between the two states of being is thin. It grows permeable when we're not looking. A friend turns me on to Ludwig Wainwright III's 1973 classic, The Swimming Song. It's all about the quintessential experience of summer swimming in oceans, pools, and public reservoirs. Wainwright celebrates the whoop of joy freedom that swimming grants us. And yet even this buoyant song reminds us of the boundary line. This summer I went swimming. This summer I might have drowned. But I held my breath and I kicked my feet and I moved my arms around. Then it continues. I salt my wounds, chlorine my eyes. I'm a self-destructive fool. There's caution here. And yet we dance near that line anyway, because there's something there to see. In the documentary Fish People, filmmaker Keith Malloy interviews surfers, spearfishers, swimmers, and others to create a vivid picture of how their lives are transformed by the sea. These are people who live in the water for all of its sensory immediacy, and also for the outlook it fosters. At some point or another, they all feel compelled to speak about how the ocean brings them to a hyper-awareness of our precarious existence. The young Tahitian Matahi Droli, who grew up surfing the storied Chopo Surf Break, is shown blasting through some of the biggest barrels he'd ever surfed there, including the ride that garnered him worldwide acclaim when it was caught on film and won an award sponsored by Billabong in 2015. He was 16 years old. His commentary on the vivid experience of this wave? "I thought I was going to die," he says, with a little disbelieving laugh. In another scene from the film, the champion spearfisher Kimmy Werner, who grew up in Oahu and learned freediving and spearfishing from her father, swims calmly with a huge shark, holding on to its dorsal fin for a spell before departing back to the surface. "It is dangerous. I am scared," she says, of all the time she spends underwater. She remembers her dad telling her this if she ever got scared. "Just relax and remember how to swim." Another of Malloy's subjects is Lynn Cox, a hero to so many swimmers, including Kim. Cox, of course, holds dozens of major open water records. In 1977, she was the first to swim around the Cape of Good Hope in South Africa, entering the water by climbing down a sheer cliff and into surging 20-foot surf that repeatedly threw her back to the sand. I ask her about how open water has shaped her worldview. She says that she equates being in the ocean with an acute awareness of your life in the moment. You go out there expecting something new, but you don't necessarily know what that will be. Being in the pool, going back and forth, is not the same. Being in the ocean, Cox tells me, you could become part of the food chain at any moment. The understanding of this adjacency, this porousness between states of being, can be comforting. When the pioneer Australian surfer Dave Rastovich describes being in the ocean as meaningful play, whether it's swimming, surfing, or floating on an inflatable raft, I get it. When my dad died, I just kept going in the ocean, he says. It was what made the difference in his acceptance of life and death. Kim remembers swimming 17 miles across Cook Strait, a stretch of water between the North and South Islands of New Zealand, with a pod of dolphins. It was her first real solo expedition in March 2012, and the first of her successful Ocean's 7 endurance swims. Her grandfather was in ill health, and she felt that it would mean something to return to her home turf and swim in his honor. As a girl, Kim spent summer holidays at the beach with her grandparents, who were farmers. She was close with her grandfather, whom she called Papa. What the ocean recalls for her more than anything is sitting contentedly in the waves, being sunburned as hell, and not even knowing until the next day the degree of the burn. Her grandparents would shout when it was time to go to the ice cream store. The days felt endless. When she swims now, she feels a sensory connection to a time in her youth when there was that freedom. In the Cook Strait, Kim's boat pilot told her that 1 in 6 swimmers encounters sharks. She was anxious, but mid-swim, dolphins showed up. It was the first time she'd ever had the experience of swimming with them. They were squeaking around me like, "The cavalry is here," she remembers. She chirped back excitedly, channeling her inner 12-year-old. The dolphins zipped around and below, escorting her for just under an hour. She didn't see any sharks out in the strait, and she thinks it was because the dolphins were protecting her. Afterward, Kim beelined to her grandfather's bedside. "What I'm most proud of is being able to lie next to Papa and show him the video of me swimming the Cook Strait with the dolphins," Kim tells me. He'd fought in World War II and suffered from post-traumatic stress, but animals and nature both calmed him. Kim was grateful to be able to share her swim with him. He could no longer talk, but he smiled at her to let her know he'd heard. Not long afterward, he died in his home. A few months after his death, Kim swam the Molokai Channel between the Hawaiian islands of Molokai and Maui. At the end of that swim, she saw and heard humpback whales singing at her. In Hawaii, they call that amakua. "That's your ancestors speaking to you," she tells me. There were dolphins on that swim, too. The energy they brought made her feel like they were all in it together, that she wasn't alone. It felt primal. She could taste the life in the water. She could smell the diesel from the boat next to her. She concentrated on her hands in front of her. At night, the bioluminescence emitted by tiny marine creatures fluttered off her fingertips like glitter. Focusing on her fingers was meditative. It made her feel safe. The clarity of the water soothed her. The deep breathing steadied her. In the essay, "I Will Always Inhabit the Water," the writer Lydia Yuknovich describes swimming as being defined in large part by the great intake of air, a breath that keeps a human able to move through water as if we were not gone from our breathable blue past. You can read this as a yearning for that breathable blue past. And what swimmer among us has not longed for this? But you can also read it as an affirmation of what keeps us us. The air we breathe, the air we need, even as we put our faces in the water. Something about the rhythm of how we breathe while we're in the water changes us. Deep breathing research is in its infancy, but we know that this pace of breath is soothing. There's a feedback loop between our breathing patterns and the nerve centers that fire our anxiety responses. When we're stressed, we tend to take short, rapid breaths. If we breathe deeply and slowly, that counteracts the stress and dampens our alarm system. In this way, our arousal and breathing centers are reciprocally linked. Swimming is particular in its activation of deep breathing. It's the nature of this exercise. If you take a big breath, hold it, and then release it slowly. Kim has unusually large lungs, perhaps the ideal bellows for big, slow breaths. On the day we first met, she showed me the spot above her collarbone where an acupuncturist once poked a needle into her lung by accident and collapsed it. Those lungs carry her far when it comes to expedition swims. The breaths, then, make swimming like moving meditation. We take a breath, we hold, we pull, and glide. We take another breath. In between breaths, the thinking happens about each stroke, each kick, each breath. As we become better swimmers, there is less conscious thinking about swimming, and our thoughts are released, free to wander as they may. All the while, the body works. We notice things, how the water moves, what the temperature is like, whether the swimming feels easy or difficult. We are at once hyper-aware and loosed from our bodily constraints. Swimming in water is the only state of being I know where I feel free, writes Yuknevich, a former competitive swimmer. She has written at length about swimming for well-being, especially as she ages. Water, she says, helps a body remember that life and time are fluid. I look a little lumbering and soft, aged and lumpy. But put me in water. Put me in water for even 10 seconds, and I will prove to you that a body is anything you want it to be. I ask Tanaka, the longevity researcher, what makes swimming so good for aging bodies. Weightlessness, he says. Physical activity without the pain and damage of land-based impact. Coolness and buoyancy to reduce inflammation and support the body. And one more thing, the most important thing. I will tell you the one thing that distinguishes swimming from all other forms of exercise. I listen carefully. People enjoy it a lot more. I wait. That's it? He goes on to relate something we all know in our bones to be true. Tons of us have New Year's resolutions to exercise. After 6 months, half of us drop out. But this is where swimming has a huge benefit and advantage. We do assessments of mood state, Tanaka explains. And with identical exercise programs in running, cycling, and swimming, people place the highest enjoyment in swimming. In other words, people keep swimming because they like it. Swimming is the second most popular recreational activity in America, outranked only by walking. But swimming is the one that quite literally takes us out of our element. We swim, and we get out from under the thumb of the everyday. There's a giddiness to being in that water, Kim observes. It connects with a playfulness that we forget about as adults. I think about the way that the serious-looking older man in the pool this morning dove under the lanes on his way out, spiraling down to the bottom, arms outstretched, as if he had all the time in the world. And I think about children in the pool during afternoon family swim, their elation so palpable. Swimming is a way for us to remember how to play. Once, in thick autumn darkness while sailing around the islands off the coast of British Columbia, I jumped off the back of the boat and into the unknown. The icy water in that moment looked impenetrably black. Just for the chance to make a phosphorescent snow angel, clouds of glowing bioluminescence bloomed around me as I treaded water, a kind of aquatic light show. When I climbed out of the water and rubbed my arms vigorously, sparks flew. This is the wonder for which we immerse ourselves, says the surfer Dave Rastovich. We forget our bodies as we know them and we just swim. Years ago, a close friend and I cemented a friendship that began in college by splashing our way around Hawaii, starting on his home island of Oahu. We visited other islands too, like Kauai, where we waded into the Pacific at Palahale Beach, a remote 17-mile stretch of white sand at the end of a long, rutted dirt road that seemed as far away as you can get from anywhere. We swam in that heaving body of aquamarine, and what I remember most is the profound feeling that the ocean water had weight. In the years since, I've come to appreciate open water, an ocean, a lake big enough to generate its own waves, as its own animal. I see swimming as a way to get to know a place with an intimacy that I otherwise wouldn't have. The pleasures of swimming in a place can be everyday, routine, familiar. In 1779, a lieutenant of Captain James Cook's admired the native Hawaiian's swimming abilities with an entry in his ship's log. The women could swim off to the ship and continue half a day in the water. In Hawaiian, Polynesian, and other enduring island cultures of the Pacific, he observed the men, women, and children seemed almost amphibious from birth. This is as lovely a description of the freewheeling freedom of swimmers as any I have come across. I feel that freedom when I'm swimming in San Francisco Bay, but I am just as aware of the hazards that are ever present at its edges. Because of the cold, there's another layer of intensity to the open water experience. You don't belong here, Kim tells me matter-of-factly, but you do it anyway. With the cold, the swim is like a fire drill for your body. It's fight or flight that's engaged when you're in that water, she explains. Everything is telling you that you shouldn't be doing what you're doing, and yet you still do it. Some of the benefits of swimming derive, ironically, from daring to come as close as we can to this very fight for survival. That's the sublime, the awe and the terror together. Those moments of panic, the electric flashes of fear, are elucidating, exhilarating. The act of getting in is a small defiance of death itself. In her 1937 essay, Undersea, Rachel Carson eloquently described the ocean as a tangible way for humans to contemplate the vast interconnectedness of life. Individual elements are lost to view, only to repair again and again in different incarnations in a kind of material immortality, she wrote. It doesn't matter if it's the ear bones of whales or the teeth of sharks. Against this cosmic background, the lifespan of a particular plant or animal appears, not as drama complete in itself, but only as a brief interlude in a panorama of endless change. We're all connected in this vastness, and our presence in the sea is but a blip, a shout into the void. We shout anyway. To what lengths will one person go to chase the sublime? Back in the sauna at the Dolphin Club, Kim is cooking up plans to be the first person ever to swim the Ocean's Seven and climb the Seven Summits. It's a thrilling prospect, not least because she will have to rely on that right leg again to carry her up those peaks. She has made practice runs up two 14ers, 14,000-foot-plus mountains, that is, in California and Colorado. She still spends her mornings swimming. The only difference is that she now spends her evenings climbing the Stairmaster. In October 2017, she sends me a text, and I reflexively whoop out loud when I read it. She has just climbed to the top of Mount Kilimanjaro, the first of her summits. As she powers through the next few months, knocking off Australia's Mount Kosciuszko in December and Mount Aconcagua in the Andes in January, she dives headfirst into mountaineering training. She hits the gym several times a week, carrying a 50-pound backpack full of birdseed. She has Denali in her sights, and then Everest. She wants an all-female Sherpa team. Her next goal? To become known as the ultimate adventurer of land as well as sea. Swimming is the means that got her here. To even dream of such a thing. It healed her, body and soul, and brought her to a new state of exuberant health. At that moment in the sauna, Kim's goal was a secret. Well, from the public, anyway. But she couldn't remember who else she'd told, so she asked everyone in the sauna to keep it close. Though Kim first set off on her swim expeditions to regain a sense of self she'd lost, to revive herself in the wake of almost losing a limb, over time that motivation changed. Through swimming, her focus gradually pulled back to take in the world beyond herself. She says there's nothing solo about a solo swim. "There's a joy in making these swims bigger than myself," she says. Two of her last major swims had to do with bringing people together. In November 2016, she led a team of swimmers across the Dead Sea between Israel and Jordan, the first people ever to complete that swim, to highlight what the countries were doing to combat climate change in the region. "We were like a swimming science experiment," she says. "I had to put Vaseline in places I never would have dreamed of putting it. The salt burned my eyes like acid." But she would do it all again. Her goal was to get the Israeli and Jordanian governments to cooperate and let her do the swim. She succeeded. The experience gave her heart and hope, 6 months later, to do the next swim. On Cinco de Mayo, 2017, Kim swam 6 miles around the existing border wall from the United States to Mexico with a team of 11 other swimmers from around the world, from San Diego's Imperial Beach to Tijuana. They worked with the human rights organization Colibri, which identifies people who have died in the crossing, no matter what the route. Her co-leader was the Mexican swimmer Antonio Arguiz. A few months later, he would go on to be just the 7th person, after Kim, to complete the arduous Oceans 7 Open Water Challenge. Kim had the cooperation of the U.S. Coast Guard and Customs and Border Patrol, as well as the Mexican Navy, a colossal feat in this era of contentious border politics between the United States and Mexico. She phoned up everybody herself, emphatic that the swim was not about politics but about our common humanity. As she swam up onto the beach in Tijuana, she saw more than 100 Mexican school children on the cliff cheering and wearing t-shirts supporting the swim. Mother Teresa came to mind. "I alone cannot change the world, but I can cast a stone across the waters to create many ripples." It wasn't a bad metaphor, Kim thought, to understand the way that water connects us all, the commonality of it, the communality of it. She wants to make ripples. Kim and the other swimmers were received in the water by the Mexican Navy to process their paperwork. Their faces were radiant. They were feeling every emotion. Kim swam up to the boat, exhausted, but she grinned and asked, in a neighborly way, to great laughter, if she might borrow a cup of sugar. Community. Beyond the wave they had gone through, they finally showed, side by side, still 6 feet apart, swimming shoreward with a steady stroke until the next wave should make them body surfeit or face and pierce it. Jack London, The Kanaka Surf. The man floated in the pool, a speck of cool in a sea of hot. The brutal midday sun had burned off, leaving a lingering warmth in the desert air. Late afternoon, early evening. These were the best times to swim. If he looked up, he could see the palm-fringed canopy of the trees that lined the Baroque open-air pool, offering merciful shade to those seated at the edge. Turning his head, he could see the diving platforms of varying stratospheric heights and the exquisite handcrafted tile that lined the terrace. If he dove down into the rich, layered blue depths, he could pretend he was in the Caribbean. If, while floating, he held his head in a certain way, submerging his ears, he could avoid hearing the constant sound of firing practice, a percussive paka-paka-paka-paka that never let up. Even though I know all about Green Sahara paleo lakes by now, swimming in the desert still sounds like a kind of fever dream. The man, Joseph J. Taylor, often felt that way himself. In Baghdad, which has been called the hottest place on Earth, temperatures can exceed 120 degrees in the summer months. But despite being surrounded by desert, Baghdad itself is a green city. Situated along the winding Tigris River, its banks lined with willows, palms, and poplars. At one of the serpentine bends in the river, you will find Saddam Hussein's royal palace and its outdoor pool. The expansive swimming pool was commissioned by the dictator to please his 2 murderous sons, who were fond of swimming. It had an irregular bean shape, 33 yards at its longest, and a magnificent poolside decor that included dramatic lighted fountains, tall leafy trees, and a pillared stone rotunda of heroic dimensions. Between 2008 and 2010, Jay was stationed in Baghdad as a cultural attaché for the U.S. Foreign Service. It was a volatile period in Iraq. The U.S. Embassy was situated on the grounds of the Royal Palace. Its official name was the Republican Palace, one of the many palaces and opulent homes that Hussein had built in strategic locations around the country, 81 by one count. Each of them had a pool, an unequivocal sign of wealth in the desert. The Republican Palace was the residence where the dictator liked to entertain visiting heads of state. He himself did not live there, but it had 258 rooms and sprawling grounds. At the time Jay was there, the palace anchored the Green Zone, where the international community resided, military, diplomats, and civilians alike. It was deemed the safest place in Baghdad, though the first few months of Jay's tenure saw incessant shelling of the zone, with numerous casualties. Here, the idea of an outdoor swimming pool seemed, to put it mildly, a little cuckoo. Especially one like this, adorned with 18-foot fountains and lighted with standing chandeliers for nighttime swimming. Jay couldn't believe that he got to swim in it, even if on more than one occasion he had to jump out of the deep end at the scream of an air raid siren and, still dripping, clamber hastily into a concrete bunker as the boom-boom of exploding mortars vibrated around him. He swam every day, and he wasn't alone in his love for the pool. Daring soldiers made use of the tall diving platforms and posted their exploits on social media. But mostly people just liked to get in, paddle around a bit, sit at the edge, shoot the shit. Jay would occasionally see other swimmers doing laps. There was this one woman who served joint forces detail. She had a graceful freestyle stroke, and when she stopped to chat, a charmingly thick Australian accent. The swimming lessons began one evening when Jay, after his workout, spotted his colleague, Andre Rembolamanana, a tank of a man from Madagascar. Rembolamanana was an experienced kickboxer on land, but in the water, he was flailing, thrashing so violently that Jay feared he might drown. "Andre, what are you doing?" Jay asked him. "Just swimming, boss," Rembolamanana replied. Jay offered to take on Rembolamanana as a student. Next, he signed up Valia Krasiva from Bulgaria and Sandy Yannick, also from Madagascar. Before long, strangers started inquiring at Jay's office about swim lessons, and he set up two beginner classes a week. Cooks, drivers, translators, peacekeeping troops, helicopter pilots, people from all over the world, from all kinds of places and backgrounds, wanted Jay to be their swim coach. Merlin Espinal from Honduras, Indrani Pal from India, Maka Baradzi from Ukraine, Mai Shahin from Lebanon, J.P. Santana from Mexico. It was a miniature United Nations, a global diaspora of people who had never learned to swim. They called him Coach Jay, and they called themselves the Baghdad Swim Team. Coach Jay is a pen pal of mine. We began corresponding after he read an essay that I'd written about swimming as the last refuge from connectivity, the digital kind. He wrote to me to argue the opposite, that swimming is a way to form community, forge bonds, and find solace in a common pursuit. In 2009, he received an award from then-Secretary of State Hillary Clinton for his service to the community in teaching all those wartime swimming lessons. I wondered about all those people who ended up in Baghdad never having learned how to swim. And I wondered how is it that some of us get to swim, and what stops those of us who don't? What forces keep us out of the water? And are they the same, no matter where you come from? This is about how swimming has brought us together, and how it has kept us apart. 8. Who gets to swim? In America, the pool is a privilege. People have historically had complicated feelings about water, mixing in it deliberately as men and women, as rich and poor, as black and brown and white, can stir up all kinds of fears. As a society, we've kept different groups apart based on these fears. Public pools first proliferated in big cities like New York and Chicago at the turn of the 20th century. Throughout the Progressive Era, swimming pools were places where blacks, whites, and immigrants swam together, regardless of race, in the interest of hygiene, writes the historian Jeff Wiltz in Contested Waters, his engrossing social history of the swimming pool in America. These early municipal pools were, in essence, giant bathtubs for working-class neighborhoods. They also corralled rowdy, half-naked youths away from public waterways, where they were perceived as nuisances. On a hot summer day, kids will be kids. Men and women, though, were separated and swam on alternating days. By the 1920s, things had changed. Cities began building larger recreational pools that were intended primarily for public leisure instead of public bathing. Men, women, and families were finally permitted to swim together in the urban-led effort to encourage community socializing. Marquee pools included Fleischhacker Pool in San Francisco, a 1,000-foot-long saltwater pool so gigantic that it required lifeguards in rowboats when it opened in 1925, and Astoria Pool, a grand Art Deco swimming and diving complex overlooking the East River between Queens and Manhattan that opened in 1936. Between the 1920s and the 1950s, tens of millions visited the country's municipal pools each year, and they did it for fun. Coach Jay himself learned to swim as a boy at a YMCA in downtown Baltimore in the early 1950s, in an old, tiled indoor pool that reverberated with the particular mayhem of children shouting and splashing in a confined space. It was the golden age of the Y, when young kids didn't have to wear swimsuits. At 4 years old, Jay was more comfortable swimming than walking. Swimming was important to his mother. The family took vacations to the glorious 10-mile stretch of beach in the resort town of Ocean City, Maryland. Community swim clubs proliferated in the Baltimore suburbs, where Jay swam on his local team until he became a lifeguard. While in college at Tufts studying government, he spent summers managing a pool in Baltimore. He taught lessons in swimming and life-saving. But during those same decades, the unprecedented mixing of men and women in recreational pools intensified the old fears of interracial mixing. Though class lines had been erased at the pool, race lines hardened even further, resulting in riots and racial segregation. Black swimmers were attacked by white crowds in pools from Pittsburgh to St. Louis. At one Harlem pool in New York City, blacks and Puerto Ricans who lived just blocks away were deterred from entrance by the threat of violence by white swimmers. In the 1950s and 1960s, pools became sites of civil disobedience, and so did other aquatic spaces. Blacks across America protested being barred from public beaches with wade-ins, showing up to swim en masse at all-white beaches by the ocean or the lake. At least one of these wade-ins in Biloxi, Mississippi, ended in violence at the hands of a white mob. The bloody wade-in took place on Easter Sunday in 1960, on Biloxi's public beach. The question of beach access for blacks wasn't settled until 8 years later, when a federal judge ruled that Mississippi's Gulf Coast beaches were open to everyone. This was a fight not just for the right of access, but for the right of recreation, of leisure, no matter what your skin color. Many activists saw pools and beaches as the ultimate symbols of that freedom. In the mingling of bodies, in the act of sharing the same water with others, you can read volumes. The volumes speak of acceptance. But when desegregation did happen, it wasn't always with the hoped-for results. In cities all across America, pools began to empty, and you can read that as a tragedy. Between 1950 and 1970, millions of Americans chose to stop swimming at municipal pools, writes Wiltz. It was a mass abandonment of public space by white swimmers, accompanied by the construction of private club and backyard pools for those who could afford it. Social divisions, not surprisingly, became even more entrenched. The historic lack of access to public pools also left America with a racial gap in swimming ability that persists today. Black children drown at a rate 5 times that of white children. And as with so many other things, Money also has a heavy hand in the way swimmers are made. In the United States, nearly 80% of children in families with a household income less than $50,000 have no or low swimming ability. By the 1980s, when I was growing up on Long Island, suburban backyard pools had become the rule for families with means. As Wiltz put it, backyard pools were installed because their owners wanted to turn inward and privilege family over community. While more and more of America's numerous public pools, which provided for everyone else, were closed due to lack of use and funds, many of them fell into disrepair. My family was lucky enough to live not too far from one of these community pools, one that was not in disrepair. When I was 8 years old, my parents gave me a choice: soccer or swim team. I chose swim team, as did my brother. Andy and I were tired of getting our shins kicked, and we didn't much like soccer anyway. We spent the next 10 years swimming with a scrappy local team 2 miles away. We loved not just swimming, but also the kids we swam with. The feeling of belonging. This was our tribe. We made lasting friendships that crossed towns, cultures, and income brackets. Unlike our town, the Freeport pool was racially diverse. In that pool, there were brown and black bodies. In that pool, kids did not jam up the corners of their eyes with their fingers or make fun of my last name. In that pool, with all those other kinds of bodies, my body started to feel like mine in a way that was good. Another thing about that team, it was co-ed. The original prohibitions at public pools were put in place in fear of this very thing: people of different races, genders, and backgrounds mixing together. For us, it was not so complicated as all that. Just puberty on the pool deck. Every day we sipped from the heady cocktail of hormones and H2O, bodies simultaneously attracted and repelled, pulled and pushed, all invited to jump together into one chlorinated rectangle of possibility. This was freedom. It was a window open to the future, away from the strictures of home, parents, rules. Chlorine carried with it an appealing whiff of excitement. We could play at something we did not quite understand. 9. A mini United Nations. Jay had been in Iraq just 3 days when he woke up in a daze and found his friend J.P. Santana's prosthetic arm on his doorstep. A second before, Jay had been juggling his first load of Baghdad laundry, depositing it in his FEMA trailer just inside the complex that housed most of the embassy staff. Then came the mortar blast. It threw Jay against a wall, and he blacked out. It blew J.P., who'd come by to collect Jay for dinner, 30 feet down the road, minus his arm. J.P. yelled to Jay, "Let me hear your voice. I'm okay. Are you okay?" Jay shouted back in the affirmative. JP's own trailer was obliterated. A man across the street was killed. If JP had been just a little bit later to Jay's door, if he'd decided to shower, Jay says, he would have been dead. Amid the dust and debris, JP retrieved his prosthetic arm, and the U.S. Army Special Forces quickly arrived to seal off the trailer of the man who was killed. They carried the body away. JP's trailer, still smoldering, was cordoned off. The troops told JP and Jay to come back in an hour. With nothing else to do but wait, the two men headed to dinner at the cavernous mess hall. Outside the door was an oil drum full of sand, into which armed personnel were required to discharge their weapons, click, click, to show that they weren't loaded. The odd thing is, even the first time being in a bombing situation like that, we just get up and say, "I hope they still have meatloaf," Jay tells me, shaking his head. "Because what can you do? You just pick up life and go on." During times of war, people seek normalcy. Going to market, hosting dinner with friends, looking at baby pictures. I remember my friend's mother, who served as a combat nurse in Vietnam, saying that routine in the midst of chaos was important to her. Relationships were essential. It was a way of showing the world, she told me, that something vital hadn't yet been knocked out of us. In 2008, 5 years after the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq, Baghdad was unstable, despite a significant surge in troops to control the sectarian violence. But still there was optimism. After decades of suspension, the Iraqi Fulbright program was resurrected, and Jay was tasked with finding promising young Iraqi intellectuals who were interested in completing advanced degrees in the United States. He flew to universities by helicopter, wearing a military helmet and a 30-pound armored vest, because transport by air was far safer than traveling on the ground. Soldiers had to be in uniform at all times, outfitted in camouflage fatigues and carrying weapons, unless they were working out in the gym or in the pool. Jay spent many of his days in the palace's cavernous green room, a former reception hall. It was then serving as the Office of Public Affairs. Among its most prominent features were 50-foot ceilings and vainglorious portraits of Hussein covered in tarps, and that glorious pool, glinting just outside. Jay's training as a public affairs officer included what to do in the building.